Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Among the most pervasive ideas in public policy is the notion that the private sector, driven by profit, must be more efficient, more productive, more effective than government. This is often taken as established fact, or at least as an article of faith, and is offered as justification for privatizing some government functions and partnering with the private sector on others. For example, President Trump has touted partnering with private business to rebuild America's decaying roads and bridges. Jonathan Marks, a Penn State law professor and bioethicist, examines the problems of public-private partnerships in his new book called Perils of Partnership, Industry Influence, Institutional Integrity, and Public Health. It's published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Jonathan H. Marks to our show today. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe we should just start off with the most basic things. What are public-private partnerships?
So they take many forms, but in essence, they usually involve governments partnering with corporations, sometimes trade associations. Often they throw academic institutions and, for example, public health NGOs into the mix. And sometimes when they do that, they call them multi-stakeholder initiatives or platforms. And I really want to try and cut through all the terminology and say, look, what's actually going on here and why is it problematic?
At the beginning of your book, you have almost a page and a half of the various letters that are used by in describing these different things, PPG, RHO, whatever.
So sometimes
I just made those up.
So there are a variety of acronyms, but more important, I think, than the acronyms, whether it be PPP or MSI for multi-stakeholder initiative, more important, I think, is what is actually going on behind these arrangements. And one reason I argue to jettison not just the practice of public-private partnerships, but the language, is the language doesn't really tell you anything about what's going on.
You note that some common arguments for them are, I'm quoting, governments cannot solve these problems alone. Industry needs to be part of the solution. Public officials can use these relationships to exert leverage over the private sector. And you challenge what you call that deceptively appealing narrative. None of that's true?
So these are very, very popular narratives. The reason why these narratives are offered is because public officials are often strapped for cash, and industry is quite happy to come with a checkbook. Mm-hmm. But industry doesn't do it for no reason. Industry does it because it's a way of wielding influence. And I think we should totally expect corporations to try and wield influence to the full extent permitted by the law, but it's the responsibility of government to insulate itself from that kind of influence.
And if industry is concerned that it may look like it's trying to exert influence, sometimes they actually set up charitable institutions that they fund so it doesn't look like they're involved?
So sometimes those contributions can be mediated through foundations. So to give you an example, when Philadelphia was first considering a soda tax in 2011, the American Beverage Association pulled together $10 million from Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Snapple, and its own funds. And then it funneled that through a new foundation that it created for that purpose.
And they were invited into the conversation?
Well, what's really interesting is that that's an unusual arrangement. Some people do consider that a partnership, but another way of looking at it is that the soda tax did not pass in Philadelphia that first time around. And one reason why many people surmise that it did not pass is because the city council obviously felt very strongly about supporting the recipient, which was the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
But that's a perfect example of what I was going to ask next. Don't governments and businesses have different interests and goals? How can a partnership serve both of them?
So I think that's the fundamental problem, is that government has an obligation to protect and promote the public good. In the case of a public health agency, that means protecting and promoting public health. Corporations' existence depends on them making a profit by selling goods and or services. And those two can diverge in very fundamental ways. And if there's a good illustration of that, it's perhaps in the opioid epidemic, in which a handful of corporations, not just opioid manufacturers, but also distribution companies, made billions of dollars and exacerbated public health crises that the White House Council of Economic Advisors estimates costs in excess of $500 billion a year. And that's in addition to the hundreds of thousands of lives, over 200,000, that have been lost in recent years to the epidemic.
You point out that for a conference on the opioid epidemic, in fact, the National Institutes of Health held a meeting in 2017 to combat the crisis. They turned to executives from Purdue Pharma for advice. Purdue Pharma has come under fire as for pretty much being pushers of OxyContin, their drug.
So they held a series of meetings in 2017 at which a number of pharmaceutical companies were present. And one of those, as you say, was Purdue Pharma, who pleaded guilty in 2007 to misleading doctors and patients about the addiction risks of OxyContin. And then, according to recent court filings in Massachusetts, continued for another decade to aggressively market the drug.
Saying that it was perfectly safe to continue using it over a long period.
Well, what's really interesting is the drug was essentially approved as a cancer therapy, and they were aggressively marketing it to physicians for all other kinds of chronic and acute non-cancer pain. And I would add that at the same time as the NIH was inviting them into the room to be partnering or to discuss the possibilities of partnering, they were running ads in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, saying, "We, Purdue, are partners in solving the crisis," and at the same time, we're also working on plans to expand the opioid market.
So what came out of that conference? Did anything positive come out of it?
So the conference was, these series of meetings are designed to draft an agenda for solving the problem of obesity and the related problem of pain management. And one thing that I think is remarkable is, but also not surprising in some ways, is the emphasis on developing new pharmaceuticals. It is certainly true that pain management is a problem, but we should be wary about partnering with the private sector to create new pharmaceuticals. It's the job of the government to ensure that any new pharmaceuticals are actually safe and effective. And we've already learned from the aggressive marketing practices and history of more than one drug company, not just Purdue, in the past, that they tend to downplay the risks and exaggerate the benefits.
As striking as this example is, you argue that we should not just look at individual partnerships in isolation. Why? Aren't some more egregious, like the one we were just discussing, than others?
So some partnerships are more problematic than others. So, for example, partnerships that use corporate logos and color schemes that essentially burnish the reputation of corporations and promote their leading brands, as often happens in the soda industry. That's an example of egregiously problematic practices, but it's a mistake to focus just on that. It's really important to ask the question, what are the systemic and cumulative effects of these arrangements? How are they distorting entire fields of research? And how are they shaping problems in ways that are favorable to corporate sponsors and their associations?
How does a partnership differ from delegating government work to a private contractor or from outright privatization?
So those are two other areas that merit consideration on their own. And they what I would argue is that sometimes simple contracting out doesn't necessarily create the same kinds of problems as a partnership. When you make a contract with somebody, the quid pro quo, what everyone gets in return, is specified in the agreement. But partnerships work in a much more subtle and insidious way. I give you X million dollars for your public health initiative, and I may ask for nothing in return. Mm. But of course, subtle influence and reciprocity arises as a result of that gift. And if often people say, well, if there's no strings attached, how can it be problematic? Well, let me tell you how it's problematic. If I said to you, Leonard, here's $10 million, do with it as you please, and you had good reason to believe that I had more than that to give you, would you do anything to upset me in deciding how to spend your $10 million?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
So actually, I've been bought.
So a lot of people use the word bought and captured, and I think that can put people on the defensive. So I'd rather put it this way, that these relationships create subtle influence and reciprocity, and I describe it as webs of influence in my book, like a spider's web, incredibly, like gossamer, very fine, very subtle, but incredibly powerful.
Do close relationships between government and industry tie in with the revolving door between federal agencies and businesses?
So that is a related problem, and I actually think...
Because the same people are... who are going as representatives of industry later are going, well, may work in government and then leave and go back into industry or become lobbyists.
Absolutely. And in fact, there are some people whose careers look like FDA Monsanto, FDA Monsanto, FDA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the same person revolving continuously. These are problematic relations, and they explain, I think, why there's such a susceptibility to public-private partnerships, because people in government have often recently been in industry. But I think what you need is, you know, corporations have these strategies of influence.
But we also want people who are knowledgeable in these jobs. So isn't that part of the problem?
So it is part of the problem. And the knowledge rationale is a rationale which is often used time and again to justify these relationships, these partnerships. We want people from industry because they have those kinds of knowledge. But as I explain in the book, those arguments have been used and defeated in other contexts where we recognize that they were totally unconvincing. In the book, I talk about how we have this fundamental doctrine of separation of powers. There'd be lots of practical benefits for the White House sitting down with the justices of the Supreme Court and congressional leaders in order to figure out the next generation of healthcare reform, right? We'd save the 10 years of litigation that plagued Obamacare. But we don't think that's a good idea. You could use the information rationale, the experience rationale, all these things to justify it, but it's problematic because the Supreme Court couldn't do its job if it were partnering with the other branches of government. And its job is to determine the constitutionality of laws and hold the other branches accountable.
You're describing a situation that we're going through right now between the White House and Congress. And the Supreme Court eventually probably will be involved as well.
Yes, but it has to be, the Supreme Court has to maintain a sort of tensile relationship, a relationship of tension with these other branches of government. Otherwise, it won't be able to do that job.
On the other hand, the president gets to name Supreme Court justices. So there is to some degree, this is almost like what you've been discussing with these other kinds of meetings, these other kinds of partnerships. We're assuming that the Supreme Court justices that the president has appointed are going to pretty much agree with his idea of how this country should be run.
Well, you know, there are historical examples of Supreme Court justices who have then taken very different turns from the presidents who appointed them. And I have other ideas, which I don't touch on in the book, about perhaps better ways of appointing Supreme Court justices. But I think the most important thing to recognize is that we totally recognize that separation is important between the branches of government, sort of public-public separation. We also recognize that separation is important between corporations, private-private interactions. So we don't think that United and USA should get together and price fix or divide markets because we pay more. So if we get that separation is important between the branches of government, public-public separation, and we get that it's important between corporations, private-private separation. How is it that we think we can solve the most pressing problems by public and private collaborating as opposed to remaining separate?
I'm speaking with Jonathan H. Marks, who is director of the bioethics program at the Pennsylvania State University and affiliate faculty at Penn State Law and the School of International Affairs. He is also a practicing attorney, and his book is called The Perils of Partnership, Industry Influence, Institutional Integrity, and Public Health. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. You focus on, mostly in this book, on health policy, but in what other areas are public-private partnerships most common and perhaps most problematical?
So you certainly alluded to them in their introduction. You know, I grew up in, I spent my youth in Thatcherite Britain, and, you know, arguably Margaret Thatcher was responsible for really launching what they called PFIs, private finance initiatives, but a kind of public-private partnership.
Hadn't happened before then?
She really put them on the map as the paradigm.
Did the same thing happen in this country around that time when Ronald Reagan was president, or have we been doing this for a lot longer?
So I think that there was also a coincident rise, and it's no coincidence. It's because they had a strong working relationship with each other. And I think these relationships do create problems. I mean, I have other colleagues who work more on transportation infrastructure. But a good example is that often, you know, when these initiatives result in the construction and the running of new bridges, the contracts are constructed so that the burdens tend to fall on the public authority and the profits tend to accrue to the private partner.
Do government contracts with businesses for prisons or for data collection or for construction count as public-private partnerships?
So, again, it depends on how the relationship is constructed. I would prefer to focus, as I say, rather than the language, on what's actually going on in that particular agreement. I have a colleague in Israel, by the way, who successfully challenged the private prison concept because, he argued, it was the function of the state to imprison, not the function of the private sector.
In this country, at the end of the Obama administration, there were challenges being made to the private prison industry, but now it's thriving, and there's talk about privatizing prisons once again, even to a further extent. So this is an ongoing debate.
Yes, and privatizing creates, as I say, problematic incentives. So the idea is that
the VA is another case, isn't it, where there's a lot of talk about privatization?
Well, I should say that the VA, though, has one...
Sorry for interrupting.
No. So one positive thing about the VA is it's one of the few entities in the U.S., government entities, in fact, the only one that can actually negotiate drug prices. So that's one way in which the VA is empowered in a way that other entities aren't.
And has that worked in a positive way for the VA?
So the VA certainly has problems of its own, but healthcare will be a lot more affordable in this country if Medicare and Medicaid quota could also negotiate drug prices with pharmaceutical companies the way the VA can.
There have been calls for it, but there's a lot of resistance in Congress. Is that because of the people who fund the campaigns of so many of our legislators?
Campaign finance, I think, is a major part of the problem, and that's why I think the governments have to develop comprehensive strategies that deal with the implications of partnerships, lobbying, and revolving doors.
Why is health policy an area of special concern from the standpoint of public-private partnerships?
I think it's a particularly acute problem. It's one thing to talk about where the benefits and burdens fall in a partnership relating to the construction of a bridge, for example. But when we have partnerships in the sphere of public health, it's not just questions of institutional integrity, the integrity of government agencies that partner with the private sector. There are really fundamental questions about the way whole bodies of knowledge are shaped, the way public health interventions are drafted and crafted that may affect the health of millions of people. It's a deeply problematic area.
Are there examples of such partnerships that the average New Yorker might have encountered? You're in Pennsylvania, so...
So I'm in Pennsylvania, and I focused more... let me give you... I talk about a number throughout the world, and maybe as I'm talking, some from New York will come to mind to either of us. But just to give you an example... a major soda company, you can guess the name probably, partnering with a bunch of local authorities to run exercise initiatives in parks throughout London, a city I lived for 10 years.
Because these soda companies are multinational companies.
Absolutely. And they have strategies in multiple countries. And those strategies, what was interesting is, in relation to the exercise initiative I was talking about, there was a kind of independent evaluation to see how it was doing. And people said, yeah, I feel better about the soda company as a result. And that's exactly what the soda company wants.
So the PR is a part of this whole process.
It is absolutely a whole part of it. The function of these initiatives is to burnish the reputation of corporations and detract from the role that their products may be having in a public health challenge or crisis.
Can't it work the other way, although I'm not sure whether this falls into the purview of what you're discussing, the plans for Amazon to come to Queens and open a facility there, and the fact that the state was going to give it almost $3 billion and build a heliport so that Jeff Bezos wouldn't have to, I guess, take the L train to his office.
So this is the most acute example of, and maybe this was the New York example you were gesturing toward.
No, I wasn't, but it just occurred to me while you were talking.
No, and it's a really interesting question. So obviously, from the position of local government, there are benefits to be had from bringing a major corporation to town. But one has to think about these incredible tax incentive packages and the way they might actually detract from vital public funding sources that the city desperately needs.
It's interesting how it's been interpreted so differently by the opponents and the supporters. The mayor and the governor see this as a loss of potential tax revenues because so many jobs would be created. And others are saying, gee, we're going to give the richest corporation in the world $3 billion. Wouldn't that money be better spent fixing the subways?
So, absolutely. And actually, there's a great movie, which I don't think got much attention, called Little Pink House, which tells the history of the famous Supreme Court case, the Kelo case, which involved... It was a kind of public-private thing. The end goal was to produce a factory to manufacture Viagra in New Jersey. Mm. And a lot of people were forced
out. That's a real need.
Were forced out of their houses in order to do so. And what's interesting is that when the company did the recalculation and the tax benefits weren't as big as they thought, they pulled out, and all these people had already been forced out of their houses. So often these arrangements that look really beneficial for the public, once you really delve down and look at what the tax benefits and tax incentives are for the private sector and how much they're really going to cost the public sphere, the public sector, these turn out to be not so attractive.
But this is a common practice all over the country. Right now, Atlanta is a major city for movie makers because of tax incentives. For a long time, Brooklyn was because of tax incentives. Greenpoint is still a home to a number of TV shows. I think Toronto was doing it for a while. Are these good? They obviously bring jobs to the area, but in the end, are the tax incentives a losing proposition?
So it's interesting that very often the default way of thinking about collaborations between public and private is just to do a cost-benefit analysis. Does this bring us more money than it costs us? And I argue that that's a mistake, to think about things solely in that way. We're all trained to be utilitarians and do cost-benefit analyses. But sometimes there are more fundamental reasons not to do something. Right? We may have a duty to protect vulnerable populations, to protect a local community. And that duty may be so fundamental as to override, in some cases, the simple cost-benefit analysis.
You write that we lack, quote, a rich body of norms to protect the public from harms caused or exacerbated by collaborations between the public and private sector. How have norms changed?
So when I was talking about norms there, I was thinking about norms embedded in laws, policies, and the like. And what I was really suggesting when I wrote that is that we have these norms that I described before, the separation of powers about the branches of government. We have huge bodies of antitrust law about the relationships between corporations. So we have these norms for public-public and private-private. But what about norms for public-private, the interface between the two?
They've never been established.
So we have little pockets, like there are public procurement rules that talk about the ways in which governments have to follow procedures when contracting out to the private sector. But we don't have a richer body of rules to deal with these collaborative public-private partnerships in the same way.
Do they vary from city to city, state to state, or are there federal laws?
So there are both. But what I argue is that what we need is more than public procurement rules. So there are these tiny pockets of rules, but we need something thicker and more substantial. And sometimes they might be laws, but sometimes they might be institutional policies. Sometimes they might start as policies and become laws. But what I'm really arguing for is to think in a more sophisticated way about building a set of principles that might govern the relationships between public and private. And I think that should promote what I argue in the book should be the new default, which is separation, not collaboration.
So you're opposed to partnerships totally?
What I argue in the book is that we should have a default of not collaborating with an extremely compelling case required to do otherwise. We exist in the opposite universe where the default is to partner and you have to persuade people that it's wrong. I think that governments, public health agencies have a responsibility. They have to be able to show their constituents, the voters, that they did not have an alternative. Now, I think in many cases that would be impossible to discharge. I do not think that in the case of the local authorities in London, they would be able to show that in order to run exercise initiatives in public parks, they needed to take money from a soda company.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, they didn't, obviously, but they wanted the money.
They certainly wanted the money, yes. But, you know, one of the
would there have been another partner that would have been better? Maybe a gym?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because there was something called the Responsibility Deal Networks that were established in 2010-11 by the Minister of Health in Britain. And this was as an alternative to regulating industry and addressing by regulation the role that those industries were playing in public health. And they created an exercise initiative that was, you know, in addition to the food initiative that was run by Pepsi or Walkers or, you know, major corporations like that, they had an exercise initiative that was run by the Association of Fitness Centers and Gyms in Britain. And people said, rightly in response, but that institution has no incentive to promote the creation of new public spaces. They just want everyone to get gym memberships and fitness club memberships. So that can be problematic too.
Before government grew to a point where it could handle things like Social Security or interstate highways, weren't many services that we now associate with government provided privately?
So I obviously grew up in Britain, as I've mentioned already. And when I was a child...
We're arguing about socialized medicine in this country. Britain's had socialized medicine ever since the end of World War II.
That's right. We thought it was the responsibility after the war to give everyone the health care they needed. And interestingly, at the same time, the U.S. Ratified the treaty establishing the World Health Organization, which said that everyone had the right to the highest attainable standard of health. But they didn't implement it domestically.
Well, President Eisenhower thought that what was happening in Britain would lead to creeping socialism in this country. I think that's the phrase he used.
So actually, I just want to go back to the example you, because you invited it from your comment about Britain. So when I grew up with the National Rail Service, the British Rail, which was a national rail service, a nationalized service, beforehand we'd had London and North East Railway, the Great Western Railway. And then, of course, after Thatcher, it went back to being privatized. And just to give you a sense of the ludicrous things that happened, you know, I would buy a ticket for a train and then discover that there were three different operators running the journey from Luton Airport to London, and I had the ticket from the wrong one, even though I had been assured that that would take me on the right train. And so the public, I don't believe, has been served. When it comes to making repairs. Instead of having one entity, British Rail, to address the problem, you have the people. You have to negotiate agreements between the people who own the track, the people who own the trains, the people who run the services. Becomes an administrative nightmare. And just let me say one more thing. The costs of administering a national health service, and in fact of any a government health service like the VA, are in the single figures. The cost of administering a private system with multiple insurers and multiple providers like those in the US range by some estimates from anywhere between 16% of total healthcare costs to close to 40%. So hardly efficient.
Whose latest book is The Perils of Partnership, Industry Influence, Institutional Integrity, and Public Health. It's published by Oxford University Press. You're a law professor and a bioethicist. What are the greatest legal or ethical problems presented by partnering with the private sector?
So I think that the... Did you say legal problems?
Yes. Are there?
So the fundamental legal problem, in my view, is the absence of legal norms to regulate these relationships. Mm-hmm. That's the real problem. I think there are systemic ethical issues, and we could use the law in order to address those, but we don't.
Do you discuss these things with economists and political scientists?
So I do. I have colleagues who are economists and political scientists.
Do they agree with you? Do they understand your objections?
I think, well, ironically, one criticism that is sometimes made of economists is they believe that everyone is susceptible to economic influences except themselves, which is a criticism some have made. But I think actually there are some economists who do actually recognize that these relationships are problematic. Indeed, my colleague at Harvard, Larry Lessig, also has written a book touching on some of these issues, America Compromise, and he interviews economists who've done research to support the concern about influence.
Much as an economist might take a different view from an ethicist, don't private businesses view social issues in a different way from public policymakers?
They do. The way that they view social issues is for an opportunity to build support and base amongst communities as a way to diffuse resistance to their commercial practices and support for regulation. They like to believe, I think, that they are doing good. We all like to believe that we're doing good. But actually, some empirical data suggests otherwise. There is some data that shows that corporations that engage in so-called corporate social responsibility often have a higher correlation of what you might call socially irresponsible business practices. So in other words, there's a moral compensation or licensing effect. You do something bad in your business practices, you get your knuckles wrapped, and then you engage in corporate social responsibility. The converse also appears to be true. You engage in corporate social responsibility, and then that may correlate with more irresponsible business practices.
We see in other ways, beyond what we're discussing here, when people who are under fire for their business practices wind up becoming major philanthropists, or, for example, the Koch brothers. We have a Koch Theater right here in Lincoln Center. The two museums have Sackler Galleries, the Sackler family, which has also come under fire, and I guess we could list many others. Is that all part of the same process that we're discussing?
I think that is an important part of the process. Now, interestingly, the Sackler family that owns Purdue Pharma worked very hard to keep the name of the family away from the drug company, but sometimes actually it works the other way, and it's the same name, and it might be used to promote or burnish the reputation of the company. But I think there is, of course, an important theoretical distinction between personal philanthropy and corporate philanthropy. But I think I'd also want to draw one other distinction, too, which is what I call in the book doing well, then doing good, and doing well by doing good. Mm. And the model very much has been be aggressive in the marketplace as much as you can and then do good with your profits. Right. A newer model that's emerging is do well by doing good. And we have recognized now in 30-something states in the U.S. for benefit corporations. These are corporations that still have to make a profit to exist, but they're supposed to commit to some form of public or social benefit. But those are problematic, too.
Do governments ever partner with organized labor or with public interest groups like the ACLU or the Natural Resources Defense Council?
So I think that governments have to be cautious with whomever they're partnering, often because apparently independent groups or groups that appear to be acting in the public interest may themselves be taking money from industry. What was striking, of course, was that five companies manufacturing opioids gave millions of dollars to a group of public health organizations and patient advocacy groups. And then those groups not only issued guidelines that were less restrictive regarding opioid prescribing, but they also lobbied the government and the CDC not to introduce regulations tightening the prescribing. And so governments really have to be careful who they're partnering with, because ostensibly independent organizations may themselves be even unwittingly doing the bidding of industry.
There may be a lot of cheap talk about ethics, but in practice, how much attention do legislators or policymakers pay to ethical considerations?
I think a major problem was what some people call moral blindness, others ethical fading. If you think of a problem as a business problem, as a legal problem, as a policy problem, you often neglect the ethical dimensions of the problem. And I think, by the way, that we too often think about the ethics of individuals and not enough about the ethics of institutions.
So do philosophers or ethicists offer a perspective on these issues that's otherwise overlooked?
I think that a number of my ethics colleagues have spent a long time focusing on individuals. There are some notable exceptions, Larry Lessig, whom I mentioned before, and Dennis Thompson, both at Harvard, who focused on institutional ethics and ethics in government and in policymaking. And I think that's the first important step, to recognize that ethics goes beyond what we do as individuals in our private lives.
You make a distinction that may seem philosophical to many between the common good and common ground.
Yes, this I think is a fundamental mistake that is so often made. This assumption that the common good and the common ground are the same. That if you get industry round the table with government and a few other entities and they can achieve common ground and agree a step forward, then that will promote the common good or the public good. And I think that's a mistake.
I'm reminded of the big brouhaha that occurred in 1953 when then General Motors CEO Charles Wilson was supposed to have said something like, what's good for our country is good for General Motors, or what's good for General Motors is good for our country. But isn't there a certain amount of truth in that? After all, if a company produces jobs, then it's doing something good.
So I think we obviously have to consider the impact that a large corporation has on the community by offering employment to people who live in that community, for example. But it's a mistake, I think, to assume that what's good for the company is good for the community. Think of companies that outsource jobs to the other side of the world, then they're no longer serving the community. Also think about companies whose pollutants or effluents are harming the people who live right next to the factory or the power plant.
Does anybody argue that what's good for labor is good for the country?
You see that less commonly, I think, amongst public officials than the other way around, than emphasizing that what's good for corporations is good for the country.
Isn't there a growing body of research that indicates that politicians act more in the interest of business and the elites than in the interest of the general public?
I think that is a systemic problem, and there's evidence to support that. And that's why I actually propose in the book that when government agencies are seeking input from a variety of people affected by their potential decisions, they should recognize that they're going to get a very flash, polished, glossy brochure from corporate so-called stakeholders. But little public health NGOs can't afford to generate that kind of material in order to oppose or offer an opposing view.
In 2010, First Lady Michelle Obama launched the Partnership for a Healthier America. What was its mission?
So its mission, I think, was essentially to get corporations to do better in terms of food companies, things like that, in terms of promoting public health. But what she essentially did, or what those who ran the initiative did, is they worked with companies to create voluntary pledges to change the formulation of their products and the like.
Fast food companies,
for example,
soda like, companies.
Exactly. And, you know, those who were heavily involved in this have written scholarly articles touting the benefits of this. But those who were not involved say the evidence for this is very slim. And indeed, in Britain, we had this similar arrangement, the Responsibility Deal Networks. And a number of studies demonstrated that when you ask corporations to pledge to do things better, what they will do, essentially, is make pledges to do what they've already decided to do because it reflects trends in the market, rather than in order to promote public health. So smaller portions of chocolate, for example, because people become conscious about weight gain and want to eat less chocolate, for example.
In this case, it was during the Obama administration, and you make the point that this has been a bipartisan problem. We've seen similar things happening, whether the Republicans or the Democrats were in power.
Absolutely. There are.
They all have bought into this concept?
There is support for public-private partnerships, partnering with industry on all sides of the political aisle, and there has been historically. And one of my goals in the book is to make people see that actually the arguments for separation between government and industry are arguments that should also appeal to you irrespective of where you are in the political spectrum.
Getting back to corporations, don't they argue that they have an obligation to make a profit to return value to their shareholders?
So they do indeed. And that's why I think we have to keep in mind that the sort of mission and purpose of corporations is very different from that of governments. And in fact, when I flagged before why even for-benefit corporations are problematic, that was one of the reasons. Even if a corporation commits to doing something for the social good or the social benefit or the public benefit, whatever the language they use, they still have to make a profit. And that's not the business of government. Government's obligations are to protect and promote public health, for example, among other things.
You discuss business relations with universities. What do businesses or universities hope to gain by partnering?
So I think that what the universities think they gain is money for new research labs, new teams of researchers, supporting graduate students. What I think the corporations think they gain is legitimacy. And I think they also believe they gain influence. But I do have...
Who owns the patents when these things are... when something is developed at a university with industry money?
So the major change came decades ago as a result of the Bayh-Dole Act, which changed in the U.S. the whole way in which universities saw their responsibilities. Up until then, they had seen it as being to foster the generation of knowledge, and now they could capitalize on patents and commercialize the benefits of research.
But hasn't some university research come under fire because it was seen as tainted by the involvement of the businesses trying to influence scientific research?
Indeed, and in many areas of research, if you separate out industry-funded studies from independent studies, the industry-funded studies usually invariably show outcomes more favorable to the industry sponsor than the independent studies. And these are studies on the health benefits of foods all the way through to the potential health risks of cell phones. You see the same pattern again and again. And herein lies a potential of glimmer, bizarrely, of a hope for a solution. Some researchers demonstrated that when physicians read a study and they know that it's sponsored by industry, they are far less likely to accept the evidence in that study. In fact, they will view it with much more skepticism. And so if that builds and grows, there will be less incentives for university to take money from industry and from industry to fund research. Because after all, it's in the interests of both the university recipients and the corporate sponsors for their research to be trusted.
Hasn't the U.S. government turned some drugs developed with public funding over to the private industry for production?
So one of the arguments often is that we need industry money in order to solve our major public health problems. But in reality, even though the figure is declining, most of the money for groundbreaking research still comes from government funding. And a lot of industry funding, for example, is spent developing me-too drugs, right? So you have one company, statin, another company wants to tweak the molecule and see if they can get a new patent and develop their own statin. So a lot of groundbreaking research is still done with federal money. But, of course, unfortunately, that money is declining.
Aren't many journals that publish publicly funded research owned by publishers like Elsevier and Taylor Francis, which then make fortunes in subscriptions because they have to be read by the people in the business, and then restrict access to the research?
That is another problem, a fundamental problem, but the NIH has actually done a little work to redress that. So if you conduct a study funded by the NIH, it now has to be made public within 12 months wherever that study, whichever journal it appears in. So the problem has been mitigated to some extent by that relatively new rule.
As a lawyer, weren't you involved in a case involving drug research in Canada, Dr. Nancy Oliveri? Can you tell us about that?
Certainly. So I represented Dr. Oliveri, who is one of the world's foremost leaders in dealing with a condition called thalassemia. She's a hematologist specializing in blood disorders. And this was a dispute that arose in Canada, but I ended up representing her in the European Court of Justice in a dispute about the approval of a drug she had been working on.
The case involved industry, academia, and government. How tangled can these partnerships get?
Well, just let me give you a sense of how problematic it was. So Dr. Olivieri became concerned that the drug she was studying, which was sponsored by an industry donor because the government had insisted she get an industry donor, the drug she was studying was of declining efficacy and increasing toxicity over time. She was worried about that. She tried to do something about it, and the drug company tried to silence her. And the university and the medical center she worked at did not stand behind her. Mm. And one of the reasons an independent report suggests why they didn't stand behind her is because the drug company was contemplating what would have been the largest ever multi-million dollar donation to the hospital and university.
Hadn't the drug company Apotex required Oliveri to sign a confidentiality agreement? That's kind of like an NDA.
So one of the research agreements had a confidentiality provision in it. This was at the end of the 1990s when universities didn't offer guidance to faculty on these kinds of agreements. But bizarrely, I don't think that agreement should have been interpreted as preventing her from discharging her ethical obligation to the research participants, which was to tell them about the new risk-benefit profile and get their consent.
But transparency becomes an issue here.
It does. And I think now that kind of agreement universities are thankfully more sensitive to. What they are perhaps not more sensitive to, however, are the subtle forms of influence and reciprocity that I discuss in the book.
In this country, is there a Democratic, Republican, or liberal-conservative divide on government relations with businesses in the way that there is in the role of government in general?
So that's my worry. I think there might be some on the left who are more skeptical of these government industry relations. But there's a broad part of the political spectrum, I think, that still seems to think they are solutions and that the ethical problems can be managed. And my warning, I think, to people would be, please do not deceive yourself and think that the ethical problems are that simple. They are systemic, they are cumulative, they distort whole areas of public health research, and they distort whole bodies of sort of government intervention.
If we need to develop a more robust set of norms to government, public-private interactions, how do we do so across domestic and international boundaries, formal or informal?
Well, I believe we have to start at all levels and see where traction develops. I think, for example, individual universities or collaborations of universities like the Big Ten should start creating communal policies to deal with this question of industry sponsorship and industry funding. I think local state local and state governments can collaborate. For example, there's an association of states' attorneys general. They can sit down together and talk about how they want to address this problem. Right now, they have collaborated in going after, for example, subprime lenders or in going after the opioid companies. Why don't they sit down and talk preemptively about how we can deal with the problem of corporate influence in public-private partnerships?
Although we have seen major differences in the way states view things like fossil fuel, coal plants, and the like. So it would be in a country like the United States, that would be kind of difficult because the federal government only has so much clout in these areas. And when the Obama administration tried to impose new restrictions nationally, it led to, it led to a serious revolt from a large part of the electorate.
I think it is time for public health agencies and governments more broadly to be ambitious. Corporations create strategies to change the world in 10 years' time. Think of the iPhones we all carry in our pockets. It is time for governments to think about broader strategies to take industry money out of government initiatives. They may not get there overnight, but they can develop a plan that will get them there in the longer term.
Apple has found a way to keep its money out of the U.S. taxpayers' pocket by shipping much of its tax problems across overseas. That's another issue here, but which we're not going to get into. In the few minutes that we have left, I guess the basic question is, should new legislation be passed to limit these kinds of partnerships?
I think we need to think about institutional policies, and I do think we need to think about laws. But I think we also have to recognize something more fundamental. If we as a society are going to tackle fundamental problems, like the opioid epidemic, the obesity epidemic, cancer, and climate change, we have to be prepared to look in every place for potential solutions. We can't confine ourselves to solutions that are consonant with the interests of industry.
Jonathan H. Marks is director of the bioethics program at the Pennsylvania State University and affiliate faculty at Penn State Law and the School of International Affairs. He's also a practicing attorney. And his book that we've been discussing is The Perils of Partnership: Industry Influence, Institutional Integrity, and Public Health. It's published by Oxford University Press. And it's been a great pleasure talking with you. Eye-opening as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robinhood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.